Welcome. It's time once again for the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, John Curry. Today's edition will feature stories from several sources, including the Disability Scoop, the Braille Monitor, and the Washington Post. We'll also feature the sixth installment of our Disability History series from the National Park Service. This time we'll be hearing about presidents and disability. We'll start our program with a piece from CBS News. It's entitled, "A Surfing Accident Left Him Paralyzed and Unable to Breathe on His Own. A Few Words from a Police Officer Changed His Life." This article is by Michael Rapolo. For former teacher Billy Keenan, life had always been about action. He had served in the Army. He mastered musical instruments, including the flute, guitar, bass guitar, and piano. As a competitive triathlete and surfer, he completed numerous 5K, 10K, and half marathon runs. "I was at the peak of my power," he said. But on September 14, 2013, his life changed in an instant while surfing at the Jersey Shore. "I rode that wave, fell off my board, hit my head on the ocean floor," Keenan told CBS News. "Everything faded to black." Keenan woke up in a hospital room 2.5 weeks later. He had been paralyzed from the shoulders down, and the medical team didn't expect him to regain independent breathing. "I resembled a train wreck," he said. "I had a halo brace drilled into my skull to keep my head and neck immobilized, and I had a trach tube doing my breathing for me." Keenan called it one of the worst days of his life, saying it was a lot of darkness. When a parent of a former student visited him at the hospital, they handed him the phone. It was NYPD Detective Stephen McDonald. McDonald had survived a shooting in 1986. He eventually forgave his assailant, but he too was paralyzed. He became a public speaker, preaching the importance of forgiveness. That day, he had advice for Keenan. At a recent talk at Berklee College, Keenan recalled what McDonald had told him. "The only reason you survive is when you're better, when you're stronger, when your rehab is over, you're going to come back and contribute in a significant way," he said. "Don't ever forget that in the end, there will be life." Keenan looked back on his life. As a former Army lieutenant and paratrooper, he realized he had been accustomed to what he called deliberate discomfort. "I was challenging myself, but positively, when times were good, never knowing that I would need those times, that evidence of resilience when everything went wrong," Keenan told CBS News. "My experience as a soldier and then my experience as a dad." Drawing on his own faith and that reminder from McDonald, Keenan overcame the odds. 4 months after his accident, he was able to breathe on his own. If you look at that picture, you would never think that that guy was ever going to be able to breathe again, Keenan said. You would never think that that guy was going to be able to teach again. In 2015, Keenan went back to teaching, but later retired. When McDonald died in January 2017, Keenan decided to start helping others, just like McDonald had, by becoming a motivational speaker. "With the energy I have left, you know, I try to be there as a steward and as a light of inspiration for, you know, the human family," he said. He published an autobiography in 2023, "The Road to Resilience, The Billy Keenan Story," and is already working on his next book, a coming-of-age story called "I Am Iron Man." Keenan believes that on that day in the hospital, McDonald delivered him a message from God he needed to hear. "I've come to realize that conversation, those words, were not coming from Stephen," Keenan said at Berklee College. "They were coming through Stephen. I truly believe that he was the messenger from God to save a terribly lost soul. And now from the Braille Monitor, we have this article called "The Advantages of a Smartwatch and Three That Are Currently Available" by Carl Bellinger, Kennedy Zimnick, and Matt Hackert. From the editor, "I remember being both amused and amazed when the comic Dick Tracy would run around with a wristwatch he would use to communicate. Given the size of two-way radio equipment and even short-range walkie-talkies, this seemed really far-fetched. What we find in this article is that the idea is not at all far-fetched, and we can get much more from a smartwatch than just a way to speak to each other. It is with gratitude to the folks at our Jernigan Institute that we run this article." Introduction. Smartwatches have continued to grow in popularity since the introduction of the Apple Watch in 2015. The combination of rapid access to notifications, accurate health tracking, and GPS features without looking at your phone has proven very popular, and the smartwatch market has exploded in the years since. Today, many companies are in the smartwatch business, from Apple and Google to Fitbit, Fossil, and many other companies. The features of these watches vary, as do the prices. For this article, we are reviewing three smartwatches from three of the largest phone manufacturers: the Apple Watch, the Google Pixel Watch, and the Samsung Galaxy Watch. All three watches fall within the $300 to $400 range. The Apple Watch specifically works with iPhones, while the Google and Samsung watches both work only with Android devices. Getting started with the Samsung Galaxy 5 Watch. The Galaxy Watch has a round face with squared edges and four prongs that stick out to hold the band in place. On one side are two buttons, which serve as back and home buttons and provide other functions when held down. The charger is a round disc that magnetically attaches to the bottom of the watch. Attaching the band is fairly difficult because it requires moving a very small piece of metal built into the band to retract the pins, aligning the band, then releasing the latch. It is quite difficult to impossible to do without sighted assistance, and will likely be impossible for someone with any level of dexterity issues. To turn on the watch, press and hold the home button for a couple of seconds. You will feel a brief vibration. After a while, the watch will be on the setup screen. Press and hold two fingers on the screen to start TalkBack. You will also need the Galaxy Wearable app on your phone. Open the app and follow the instructions to set up the watch. Configuring the Galaxy Watch. The Galaxy Watch has a number of settings that can be configured. These include everything from Wi-Fi and Bluetooth to sound, display, security, and mobile payment features. You can adjust the settings either on your watch or through the Galaxy Wearable app. The accessibility settings contain many of the same options you would expect coming from an Android phone, including TalkBack, display settings, audio adjustments, and more. TalkBack settings allow you to adjust verbosity, punctuation levels, TalkBack's sounds, and more. Interestingly, the text-to-speech rate is in the text-to-speech settings under General rather than Accessibility, which was a bit confusing at first. There is no Braille keyboard support due to the small screen, and there is also no Braille display support. Due to the dense nature of the setting screens, many users will likely find it easier to make settings changes on their phone, though making them on the watch is most certainly doable and accessible. Using the Galaxy Watch. Navigating around the watch is straightforward for anyone familiar with using TalkBack. Many of the one-finger gestures work to navigate around, and two-finger gestures can be used to change screens. The interface is largely responsive, but can slow down drastically if the watch is downloading data or doing other processor-intensive activities. This seemed particularly egregious if the watch had been powered off for a while, and the laggy behavior could last for several minutes before things returned to normal. There is also a feature where you can run your finger around the bezel of the watch to scroll through content. This seemed to cause more issues than it was worth, so I turned it off in settings. The feature does appear to work reasonably well with TalkBack, but due to the small screen, I found myself triggering it accidentally a lot of the time and causing my focus to change when I didn't want it to. The home screen. When you wake up the watch, you will hear the time and that you are on the home screen. The first screen contains the time, any activity you're currently involved in, and other customizable information. Doing a two-finger swipe right accesses recent notifications. Swiping left with two fingers takes you through a series of customizable tiles. These can contain information such as current heart rate, number of steps taken that day, your next calendar appointment or alarm, music controls, and potentially more depending on the installed apps. Activating a notification or one of these tiles will get you into that app. Lastly, swiping down from the top edge of the home screen brings up quick settings, and swiping up brings up the list of installed apps. Installing and using apps. When you first set up the watch, any compatible apps installed on your phone can be optionally downloaded to the watch. After setup, you can access the Google Play Store directly from the watch, or you can filter by watch apps when browsing from another device. Installing an app to the watch works just like it does from the phone. Just bring up the Play Store page and select Install. Once installed, swiping up from the home screen brings up an alphabetical list of installed apps, which you can scroll through. Unfortunately, the selections of apps on the Android watch are fairly limited. You can use Google Maps for GPS, YouTube Music for listening to music from your watch, and various health tracking apps. Some notable apps, such as Audible for audiobooks, which have Apple Watch apps, do not have equivalent versions for Android watches. As with any device, not all apps will be equally accessible. Handling notifications. Swiping right from the home screen will bring up the notifications panel. You can flick through your notifications and act on certain ones. You can return calls, acknowledge alarms and timers, and reply to messages with your voice. Other notifications will show the content of the notification and advise you to continue on your phone if there is no watch app for the notification. I found no real problems here and things generally behaved as expected. Calls. Making and receiving calls worked quite well on the Galaxy Watch. While not especially loud, callers came through clearly and I could also be heard even when the watch was not near my mouth. All call controls are accessible. When a call comes in, both the phone and the watch will ring. Once on a call, it is easy to transfer the call back to the phone if desired. Initiating a call is also straightforward on the watch and can be done either through the phone app or by voice. Tracking your health. A main feature of any smartwatch is tracking your health metrics, and the Galaxy Watch is no exception. From the home screen, you can get easy access to your steps and heart rate, and you can easily track various workouts. I tracked a few walks, and they seemed fairly accurate to the time and distance I actually walked. The Galaxy Watch also has automatic workout detection. For example, if you start walking, after a few minutes, the watch will start tracking your walk automatically. This can be very useful since you don't have to remember to start a workout every time you leave. It also has a feature that pauses the workout if it detects you've stopped. Again, this can be useful so that the workout doesn't get skewed while you're waiting for a long traffic light. However, this does mean that if your speed is inconsistent or you have to slow down and stop frequently, such as moving through a crowd, you can get a lot of paused, started messages rapidly, which can get a bit annoying. The Galaxy Watch also has sleep tracking, but I wasn't completely satisfied with its accuracy. It also has EKG features, which I did not test. Overall, the Galaxy Watch offers solid and accessible health tracking, and it should meet your needs, whether you're just wanting to track steps or have a more serious workout. Low vision features of the Galaxy Watch. The Samsung Galaxy smartwatch incorporates a range of low vision accessibility features to enhance usability for individuals with visual impairments. These features include customizable font size and contrast, color correction and inversion, filters, and magnification. These are accessible under the Visibility Enhancements menu within the Accessibility settings. Magnification allows users to enlarge screen content for easier reading and interaction, while font size customization ensures information is displayed in a readable format. Color inversion provides high contrast for improved visibility. The Dynamic Type feature offers a range of font sizes, accommodating users who prefer larger or smaller text. Apps supporting dynamic type deliver a consistent reading experience across the interface. Additionally, the Taptic Engine provides haptic feedback, offering tactile cues for notifications and alerts. Users can customize accessibility shortcuts and add specific accessibility features to the Control Center for quick access. These comprehensive low-vision accessibility features make the Galaxy Watch highly accessible. Apple Watch 8, Setting Up and Pairing. Setting up an Apple Watch is relatively simple, especially for anyone who has had some experience already using an iPhone and VoiceOver. Begin by powering on the Apple Watch by holding down the side button below the digital crown. Of course, the first thing any VoiceOver user will want to do is enable VoiceOver on the Apple Watch to get things started. To do this, simply triple-click the digital crown. The next step is pairing the watch with an iPhone. This can be accomplished in one of two ways: automatic pairing, which involves pointing the iPhone camera at the watch face, and manual, which involves selecting the Apple Watch and entering a pairing code on the iPhone. The automatic method is simple enough, even as a blind person, but having a manual option available is reassuring. After the two devices are successfully paired, there is a brief period of data synchronization, after which everything's all set. Settings and accessibility. As with Apple's other hardware offerings, the Apple Watch comes brimming with settings and options for customization. Therefore, one approach is simply to spend some time just using the watch, then decide how it could work better, if only it would. Fill in the blank. Then, as you browse through setting options, you have something more specific to look for. Many of the settings will look familiar to iPhone and iPad users. The VoiceOver settings will also look familiar. And of course, it being a watch, you'll find galleries of watch faces to choose from and countless ways to personalize each. One niche area smartwatches try to excel in is for health and fitness. The Apple Watch can be a pedometer, heart monitor, and a fitness coach, reminding you to get up and be active. It can even detect and time how long you take washing your hands. And keep in mind, you haven't even visited the App Store yet. Use of the watch. Once again, since we're in the Apple ecosystem here, users of iPhones and iPads will find navigating the watch interface fairly intuitive and familiar. Gestures are comparable to navigating Apple's other mobile offerings. The Apple Watch sports a digital crown, which offers an alternative method for scrolling through apps. Pressing the digital crown is a convenient way of moving back to the home screen. Wiping down with two fingers opens the notification center. Swiping up opens the control center. Both of these behave much like their counterparts on iPhones and iPads. Flicking and double tapping work just like they do on any other iOS devices. Triple tap with two fingers to enable digital crown navigation, where turning the crown allows you to scroll through apps on the home screen. Notifications. This feature might be one of the key reasons people use to justify the purchase of a smartwatch. Rather than reach into their pocket or handbag to find their phone, if it even is on your person, why not just glance down at your wrist to see who just texted, what that tweet was, read the news headline that just popped up, or see who's calling? In many respects, the Apple Watch is sort of a remote extension of the iPhone. And for a blind person, a close equivalent can be achieved by having VoiceOver read out these notifications. This too is configurable. You may want to just know you received a text rather than having VoiceOver read the text unless you tap the watch face. Health features. As noted above, the Apple Watch comes with quite a few health-related apps included with Watch OS. These include a heart rate monitor, blood oxygen monitor, ECG, cycle tracking, medications, mindfulness, sleep, and workout. These apps work in conjunction with the health app running on the paired iPhone. While a comprehensive evaluation of the health-related features and apps of the Apple Watch could fill its own article, rest assured that overall they work very well with VoiceOver, and the information they collect is accessible to blind users. What's a little harder to speak to is the accuracy of the information. As it is worn on the wrist, there might be some differences in step counting between the watch and the iPhone itself, carried different ways, i.e. in a pocket, in your hand, or in a handbag. Braille support. During my testing, I used the Apple Watch with a Mantis Braille display. Pairing the display works just like it does with VoiceOver on an iPad or iPhone. Since it's still VoiceOver doing all the work, the support is comparable to that which you get from other Apple products. While perhaps using the watch paired with a smaller display like the Chameleon might be a more functional setup, the Mantis worked well enough. Certainly, for a deaf-blind user, having this additional support would be essential, and certainly the support is as good as that which you get from Apple's other mobile devices. Low vision features of the Apple Watch. The Apple Watch offers a range of low vision accessibility features to enhance the user experience. Users can enable the zoom feature to magnify screen content for improved readability. Display accommodations allow customization of contrast, brightness, and color filters to enhance visibility. Dynamic type provides a choice of font sizes catering to individual preferences. The Taptic Engine provides haptic feedback for notifications and alerts. Customizable accessibility shortcuts and the ability to add specific accessibility features to the control center enable quick access to necessary features. These extensive low vision accessibility features make the Apple Watch highly inclusive. The Google Pixel Watch. The Pixel Watch, Google's response to the Apple Watch and Samsung Galaxy Watch, is designed specifically for Android devices. It's the newest of the three, having been released in October 2022. However, it may face limitations due to a smaller accessibility community. The setup process begins with TalkBack, Android's native screen reader, ensuring accessibility from the start. Most setup steps occur within the Watch app on your Android phone, simplifying navigation for new users. However, some accessibility settings are only accessible on the watch itself, which may be slightly inconvenient. Using the Pixel Watch. Navigating on the Pixel Watch relies on touch gestures and physical buttons. You can choose between touch to wake and tilt to wake for activating the device. Swiping down opens quick settings similar to those found on smartphones. Swiping up reveals notifications, while swiping right to left cycles through tiles, quick access apps. Physical buttons offer an alternative means of interaction. However, simulating swipe gestures using buttons would enhance accessibility. Notably, there can be a lag when using the touchscreen, particularly when the watch is out of range from the paired phone. The accessibility of the Pixel Watch. The Pixel Watch offers an accessible experience for blind or low vision users, though it may not be as polished as on smartphones. TalkBack relies heavily on swiping gestures for navigation and interaction, leading to occasional conflicts with the Explore by Touch feature. Typing on the small on-screen keyboard can be challenging, though voice input and Google Assistant provide convenient alternatives. The watch supports screen magnification through the magnifier feature, which may be challenging to use due to navigation difficulties. Font size customization and text-to-speech rate adjustments are available, as are real-time text and vibration customizations. Notifications. Notification handling is user-customizable, allowing you to choose which apps can notify you and how they behave. Notifications are not disruptive to the user experience and can wake up the device when necessary. Applications. The Pixel Watch offers a growing selection of apps, including health and fitness tools, music streaming apps like Spotify and Amazon Music, and unique features like remote camera control through the Google Camera app. Users can search for Pixel Watch compatible apps in the Google Play Store. Conclusion. Smartwatches provide a great way to stay connected with all your notifications, health features, GPS apps, and more without having to pull out your smartphone. The accessibility of these devices is impressive and can be operated by blind or low vision users. Whether you are an Apple or Android user, there is an accessible smartwatch for you. And now it's time for the next in our Disability History series from the National Park Service. This installment is entitled Presidents and Disability. But before I begin reading that, let me remind you, you're listening to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. And now, Disability History, Presidents and Disability. We must promote to the best of our ability and by all possible and appropriate means, the mental and physical health of all our citizens. President John F. Kennedy, Special Message to Congress, 1963. Nearly 50 million people live with disabilities in the U.S. This population has included our nation's presidents. Dwight Eisenhower had a learning disability. Abraham Lincoln lived with depression. James Madison had epilepsy. Franklin D. Roosevelt had polio. John F. Kennedy lived with several medical issues. Places associated with these presidents, including those in NPS parks and recognized by NPS programs, continue to honor these presidents' memories. They also demonstrate changing ideas about disability. Franklin D. Roosevelt was born in Hyde Park, New York, in 1882. Hyde Park remained an important place for the Roosevelts throughout the president's life. He was buried there after his death in 1945. In 1921, at the age of 39, Roosevelt contracted poliomyelitis. Polio is an infectious disease that can cause paralysis. At this time, there was no vaccine for polio. The vaccine was not available until 1955, when it was developed by Jonas Salk at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. As a result, Roosevelt lost the use of his legs. With the help of his family, staff, and the press, Roosevelt often tried to hide his disability from the public. Many photographs depict Roosevelt draped in a blanket or cloak, which hid his wheelchair. As president, Roosevelt supported research for the treatment of polio. He founded the March of Dimes program, which was originally called the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis. The March of Dimes today researches treatments and prevention of birth defects and infant mortality. Roosevelt also frequented Warm Springs in Georgia. There he bathed in the therapeutic mineral springs. Mineral springs and wellness sanitariums were popular forms of treatment for wealthy individuals with physical disabilities in the early 1900s. Roosevelt later purchased the Warm Springs Resort. It became a nonprofit organization and was renamed the Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation. Organized in 1955, the FDR Memorial Commission worked to promote the president's legacy. The memorial, located in Washington, D.C., and opened in 1997, is physically accessible to all visitors. Ramps allow visitors to navigate with ease through the memorial. However, the original plan did not include a statue that featured FDR's disability. Disability advocates lobbied for a sculpture which featured his wheelchair, and Congress agreed. In 2001, sculptor Robert Graham constructed the now famous statue of Roosevelt that depicts Roosevelt's disability. The John F. Kennedy National Historic Site also helps tell the complicated history of disability. The site is furnished to resemble how it looked in 1917 when John Kennedy was born. One year later, in 1918, the future president's sister, Rosemary, was born. Due to complications at birth, Rosemary was born with intellectual and physical disabilities. She talked and moved differently than her fast-paced, competitive siblings. Still, Rosemary was a very social young woman. Her parents worked hard to involve her with their busy lifestyle. She joined them on trips to England and their summer home in Cape Cod. They also sent her to boarding schools on the East Coast and in Europe. As a teenager and in her 20s, Rosemary exhibited manic aggressive behavior. Her family decided that doctors should perform a lobotomy on her at age 23. A lobotomy is a surgery that severs brain tissue. In the 1940s and 50s, doctors believed a lobotomy could relieve mental disorders. However, lobotomies also had grave side effects. Rosemary's lobotomy was a failure. She lost her ability to use the bathroom properly, and her speech was affected. Rosemary spent much of the rest of her life in an institution. John F. Kennedy, meanwhile, established several legal measures to support research and treatment for people with disabilities. Kennedy's sister and founder of the Special Olympics, Eunice, pushed the president to address disabilities in public. Since then, many presidents and members of Congress have furthered these goals. In our next edition, we'll hear the seventh and final installment in the Disability History series. It's entitled The NPS and Accessibility. The National Park Service strives to make its parks, monuments, and historic sites available to all. Programs, services, and products such as Braille alternatives of print material, sign language interpretation of tours, accessible camping sites and trails, ramps and elevators make parks more accessible. These are essential to allowing the public to fully enjoy NPS resources. We'll hear that article next time. And now here's a piece from the Washington Post entitled, "Restoring Sight is Possible Now with Optogenetics." People suffering from macular degeneration, along with other diseases that impair sight, may soon benefit from gene therapy. This piece is by Andrew Zaleski. As a child, Max Hodak learned to develop film in a dark room with his late grandfather, who was almost blind. Hodak's grandfather had retinitis pigmentosa, a congenital disease that affects one out of every 5,000 people, more than 2 million worldwide. Most people with the condition are born with their sight intact. Over time, they lose peripheral vision first, then central vision, and finally their sight, sometimes as early as middle age. He clearly had this career and was a photographer, and I saw that, Hodak said of his grandfather, who became an aerospace engineer and briefly worked on heat shields for spacecraft. But most of my memories as a kid was that he was pretty profoundly blind. Possible solutions, though, are within reach. Science, a startup company in Alameda, California, has designed a visual prosthesis called the Science Eyes, which could restore vision, albeit in a limited form, in people with retinitis pigmentosa. Hodak, its CEO, co-founded the startup after a stint at Elon Musk's company, Neuralink. Other companies, such as Paris-based biotechnology company GenSight Biologics and Bionic Sight in New York, are also experimenting with methods to restore sight. All are basing their work on a research tool in neuroscience called optogenetics, a form of gene therapy that delivers proteins called opsins via injection into the eye to boost the light sensitivity of cells in the retina, the layer of tissue at the rear of the eyeball. Therapeutic optogenetic therapy for vision restoration certainly has promise, according to Anand Swarup, a senior investigator at the National Eye Institute in Bethesda, Maryland, who has worked on inherited retinal degeneration for close to four decades. But there's still room for improvement. At least at this stage, it seems to be very good in cases where someone is completely blind, Swarup said. You should be able to find your way around. You're not going to bump into things, which is great, but you're not going to be distinguishing many different features. How optogenetics work. In normal vision, light enters the eye through the lens and forms an image on the retina. The retina itself is composed of several different types of cells, mainly photoreceptors. Photoreceptors are light-sensing cells shaped like rods and cones that contain opsins. Normally, photoreceptors convert light into electrical signals that travel to the retina's ganglion cells, which in turn transmit those electrical signals via the optic nerve into the brain, That's how you're reading the words on this page right now. In retinitis pigmentosa, the rods and cones in the photoreceptors break down and ultimately die. First, the peripheral vision goes, and people develop tunnel vision. They have to turn their whole heads just to view the world around them. Many people with tunnel vision require a cane to assist in navigating the world and avoid bumping into things like furniture. Blindness follows not long after. The breakdown of the photoreceptors, however, doesn't diminish the brain's ability to process electrical signals, and critically, the ganglion cells remain intact. Optogenetics seeks to circumvent the usual choreography by delivering opsin proteins directly to the ganglion cells, meaning they can be stimulated by light in order to send signals to the brain. The science eye contains two elements. The first is an implant composed of a wireless power cell and an ultra-thin, flexible micro-LED array that's applied directly over the retina. Surgery that's more extensive compared to other eye procedures like repairing cataracts. According to Hodak, the array, prototypes of which are being tested in rabbits, provide 8 times the resolution of an iPhone screen. The second element is a pair of frameless glasses, similar in size and shape to regular prescription glasses, that contain miniature infrared cameras and inductive power coils. Put it all together, and the process looks like this. Step 1. Inject opsins into the ganglion cells of the eye. Step 2. Install the implant. Step 3. The glasses activate the modified ganglion cells by wirelessly communicating information from the visual world. In turn, the new light-sensitive ganglion cells transmit that information through the optic nerve to the brain. The eye isn't receiving an image anymore, but rather digital information. And the results? You should be able to walk across town to buy a sandwich without being hit by a car, Hodak said. More research into retinitis pigmentosa. Other companies are already helping to bring back vision in people with retinitis pigmentosa. GenSight Biologics uses an optogenetics plus glasses approach to amplify light that genetically edited ganglion cells can decode. According to clinical trial results published in 2021 in the journal Nature Medicine, GenSight's method was able to help in locating objects on a table. That patient, a 58-year-old man, was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa at age 18. Bionic Sight has firsthand experience with patients beginning to make distinctions between features. Its method involves a gene therapy vector that transfers an opsin called chronos via injection into the eyes of their patients to boost the light sensitivity of intact ganglion cells. For those with tunnel vision, the injection of the opsins seems to be enough. For patients with more impaired vision, Bionic Sight pairs the optogenetic therapy with a pair of goggles containing a camera and neurocoding device. The camera takes in images and converts them to code, which is then sent out as light pulses to activate the opsin in the genetically modified ganglion cells. So far, Bionic Sight has treated 13 people, ranging from the very blind to patients with tunnel vision. It's really significantly helping, says Sheila Nierenberg, founder of Bionic Sight, as well as a professor of computational neuroscience at Weill Cornell Medical College. Consider the large letter E on the eye chart you might examine during a visit to the doctor's office. The visual acuity of a person who is nearly blind is 20/200. What someone with 20/20 vision is able to see at 200 feet away is only visible at 20 feet away to someone who is nearly blind. Many of her patients with retinitis pigmentosa, Nierenberg said, can't see a letter like the big E from just 2 feet away. But one patient, whose visual acuity was 20/150, he had to stand 20 feet away from the chart in order to see the letters, whereas a normally sighted person can stand 150 feet away and see the same letters, is now down to 20/40. Another patient was unable to distinguish the suits on playing cards. After receiving the opsin, the patient was not only able to tell the difference between clubs and diamonds, for instance, but he was also able to notice the differences in color. Another challenge had him trying to spot differences between plastic fruits arranged in front of him. He was able to spot the stem of the apple to tell it apart from oranges and peaches. Finally, he was asked to walk a maze with black squares at the bottom and made it through successfully. I can't explain to you how thrilling it is, Nirenberg said. It's very hopeful. One form of gene therapy for treating blindness has been available for over 5 years. Luxturna, a prescription approved by the Food and Drug Administration in 2017, is for children and adults with a rare genetic mutation that impacts the retinal pigment epithelium, the membrane at the back of the retina on which the photoreceptors sit. The prescription adds in a functional version of the gene to create an epithelium more favorable to the photoreceptors. It might slow the progression of the disease, Hodak said, but it does not regenerate any loss. That ultimately is the goal of Science Eye. Clinical trials should begin, Hodak said, sometime in the next 18 months. The company is also looking at ways to use Science Eye to help people with dry, age-related macular degeneration, which unfolds slightly differently compared with retinitis pigmentosa. Patients lose central, high-resolution vision first, and then their peripheral vision. There are milestones to cross for every company using optogenetics to help people improve their eyesight. More patients enrolled in clinical trials should help refine both opsin delivery and the ability to improve light sensitivity in retinal cells. But Hodak predicts that over the next 5 years, there will be products on the market for people like his grandfather. You always have to be really careful with what you say to patients because they're holding on for any piece of hope, Hodak said. But there's a lot of things on the horizon that are converging. It's not at a point where any one thing will fail and derail the whole field. Real progress is coming. And now from the Disability Scoop, an article entitled PBS Looks to Make Kids Shows More Accessible by Sean Heasley. PBS Kids is reworking many of its most popular shows to be more accessible to children with disabilities. The network is offering up alternative versions of episodes from 6 shows to add American Sign Language interpreters in a bid to better serve children who are deaf and hard of hearing. Given that PBS Kids content is aimed at those ages 2 to 8, the network said that many are not yet able to read captions and would benefit from ASL. PBS Kids aims to reach kids across the country with accessible, high-quality content, said Jen Rodriguez, Director of Research and Inclusive Design at PBS. This new ASL content builds on PBS Kids' extensive accessibility offerings and unwavering dedication to inclusivity, aiming to empower kids to engage with content in ways that best suit their individual needs and preferences, with accessibility top of mind. PBS Kids worked with Bridge Multimedia, which helps businesses improve accessibility, and conducted user testing to integrate interpreters on screen in an optimal way. Those behind the effort said they took pains to place the interpreter close to the speaking character and dress the interpreter to look more like the character. ASL versions of Work It Out Wombats, Pinkalicious and Peterific, Arthur, Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood, Don Quixote, and Alma's Way are now streaming on the PBS Kids website, app, and YouTube channel. There are currently 10 episodes of each show featuring ASL interpretation, but those behind the effort said they hope to expand the offerings in the future. Here's another piece by Michelle Diament from the Disability Scoop, this one entitled Social Security Tweaks Rules for SSI. The Social Security Administration is making another update to how it calculates supplemental security income benefits, this time to ensure its rules are applied more equitably across the country. The agency finalized its rule this month, adjusting how it handles so-called in-kind support and maintenance in the form of a rental subsidy. Under existing policies, individuals with disabilities can see their SSI benefits reduced if they pay rent or shelter expenses that are lower than the current market value. This often comes into play if a beneficiary is living with a family member who charges less than they would pay on the open market, for example. However, because of court rulings, there is a different standard in place in 7 states: Connecticut, New York, Vermont, Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin, and Texas. For SSI beneficiaries in those states, monthly payments are not reduced if an individual is spending more than a third of their income on housing, even in cases where their rent is less than the current market value. With the new rule, Social Security will apply the less stringent standard nationwide. As a result, the agency expects that about 41,000 people will see their SSI payments rise by an average of $132 per month. In addition, an estimated 14,000 more people are expected to qualify for SSI each year. Our mission is to continue to help people access crucial benefits, including SSI, said Martin O'Malley, Commissioner of Social Security. Simplifying and expanding our rental subsidy policy nationwide is another common sense solution that will improve program equality and will reduce agency time spent calculating and administering rental subsidy. The new policy is set to take effect September 30. The rule change is part of a wide-ranging effort from the Social Security Administration to reconsider how it handles nuances of the SSI program. Last month, the agency said that it would stop counting food as part of in-kind support and maintenance, beginning this fall, and a rule issued last week changes how Social Security factors support from other public assistance programs while calculating SSI payments. Now, also from the Disability Scoop, a piece entitled Post-Secondary Program Dealt a Blow, Costing Students $600,000 a Year in Federal Aid, by Scott Williams, Union Grove, Wisconsin. Shepherd's College is increasing its efforts to raise scholarship money after the U.S. Department of Education ruled that the college's students no longer qualify for federal financial aid. The action affects about half of the college's students and will result in an estimated loss of $600,000 a year in assistance. The Union Grove College serves about 75 students who have intellectual or developmental disabilities. Specialized instruction and job training helps post-secondary students enter the workforce and live independently. College President Tracy Terrell said administrators were able to cover the lost federal aid this year by using private scholarship funds. However, donations have not been enough to replenish the lost funds in future years, he said. The gap is still significant, Terrell said. We could use help. Union Grove and other communities have passed resolutions urging federal officials to find a way to help the college's students. And the Racine County Intergovernmental Cooperation Council has promoted the cause among its city, village, and town members. Union Grove Village Trustee Sarah Glockler said the residential campus at 1805 15th Avenue provides a learning environment that is welcoming and refreshing for students with intellectual or developmental disabilities. Many parents travel from outside Wisconsin to give their children the unique college experience available in Union Grove. Recalling a recent campus visit, Glockler said, "It was beautiful to sit down with the students and hear how much they love Shepherd's College and how much they are learning." Founded in 2008, the nonprofit college offers three-year programs that prepare students for careers in culinary arts, horticulture, or technology. It has a 75% graduation rate, and 4 out of 5 graduates find employment. The cost of attending Shepherd's College is about $60,000 a year. The Department of Education allowed Shepherd's College students to qualify for Pell Grants and other forms of federal assistance for more than 10 years before reversing the decision at the start of the current school year. Department of Education officials declined to explain their action, saying only that Shepherd's College has been issued a denial of recertification and that an appeal from college administrators is under review. U.S. Representative Brian Steele, Republican, Wisconsin, whose district includes Shepherd's College, has asked the Department of Education for clarification about the reasons for the financial aid decision. Steele spokeswoman Siobhan Luddick said the congressman also is working on legislation to make federal financial aid available again to students at the college. In his letter, Steele said cutting off federal assistance could have a significant impact on the college and its students. Traditional educational institutions do not always have the necessary accommodations and resources to support non-traditional students, he wrote. And Shepherd's College provides educational opportunities to these students. The financial aid issue comes as Shepherd's College is considering expansion outside of Wisconsin. Terrell said federal financial aid programs historically have been geared toward students with intellectual or developmental disabilities who spend at least 50% of their time in integrated settings on conventional college or university campuses. For students to qualify, these institutions must offer students with disabilities a comprehensive transition program within the context of curriculum serving a general student population. Federal officials, Terrell said, have not provided a clear explanation for why Shepherd's College students previously qualified for financial aid but no longer do. "We certainly don't agree with the Department of Education's decision on this," he said. "We've been trying to make our case, all to no avail." A notice of decertification was sent to the college in November 2022. The decision became official, Terrell said, just before students arrived on campus last fall, and only one student has left because of the change. The college could challenge the matter in court, Terrell said, but officials have decided to focus on raising private donations. Shepherd's College, he said, could never meet the federal government standards for students with disabilities within a general population or integrate in them only part of the time. "Everything we do is about them," Terrell said. "They're not a side project on our campus." Well, that's it for this edition of the Disability News Program. Thanks for joining us, and keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.